welcome to another Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. This week, I meet British director Edgar Wright as his postmodern action comedy Scott Pilgrim vs. the World kicks and punches its way onto the big screen. And from one geek who can kick ass to another, the second installment of the Stieg Larsson trilogy, The Girl Who Played With Fire, is released with Lisbeth Salander and all. I meet the director Daniel Alfredsson to discuss his vision of the Swedish thriller and why directing success runs in his family. Zan Brooks will be joining me to review some of this week's other releases, including Adam Sandler and Chris Rock in a comedy called Grown Ups and a prison drama called Dog Pound. Yes, kapow, thunk, ring ring, boom, it's Film Week. British director Edgar Wright is best known for his collaborations with the duo Simon Pegg and Nick Frost on the films Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. But this week, with the release of Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Wright has struck out alone, and in Hollywood no less, applying his Xbox aesthetics to a big studio concept film.
You're quite the opponent, Pilgrim.
Who the hell are you anyway?
My name is Matthew Patel, and I'm Ramona's first evil ex-boyfriend.
For what? Anyone need another drink?
Hugely ambitious, visually original, if not entirely successful, the film is a confident next step by a director capable of action hero-style Hollywood domination in the future. So, what better time, I thought, than to sit Edgar Wright in the director's chair.
Edgar, congratulations. Hi.
Hello. Sorry.
Congratulations on Scott Pilgrim.
Thank you.
It seems to me that this is wildly ambitious and original, visually speaking. I mean, so many films are now based on comics, but very few of them actually kind of transposed that actual comic book style to the big screen. Was it born of frustration, this whole kind of new take on the genre?
Not really. I guess because it's a comedy and also because it might appear to largely take place in Scott Pilgrim's head, it seemed like it was right to kind of use the kind of comic book tropes and even the things from video games that both comic book adaptations and video game adaptations kind of jettison. Because most of them are going for like realism. So something like The Dark Knight is not going to have kapow in it because it's you know, much more sort of serious-minded.
Did you miss the kapows?
No,
in like the Dark?
No, they have been dark.
It's
the right choice in Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight. I don't think it needs any kapows. In this, though, I felt that Scott Pilgrim, as a character, who's 22 but sometimes acts like he's 12, that he would it would kind of be the way he would choose to live his life, by sort of gaining points. And I mean, all of that stuff is there in the artwork, and it felt right to kind of bring it to the big screen, because I couldn't imagine what a straight kind of adaptation of Scott Pilgrim would be.
Yeah.
And so also I kind of, even though there's a lot of comic book adaptations that I like, I did sort of miss the sense of fun and even like, you know, bringing out the kind of pop art sort of quality.
It seems to me that that's the fun of comics in the first place, and that's often what films, what people think, they should adapt very nicely to films because they're storyboarded. But
yeah,
it's that.
And I guess also a lot of kind of comic book adaptations are looking for legitimacy, you know, in terms of that they're sort of saying, well, we're not a video game or we're not a comic book, we're a film now. And so with this, there wasn't really, because it's, you know, it's a lot more kind of fun and magical and imaginative, there was the license to kind of do anything. And that was the thing that like really attracted me to it. And even the thing of like changing the framing all the way through the film was because, you know, in comics, not every panel is 1:8:5. Like, they change all the time. So the idea of using split screen or changing the ratio all the way through kind of came of just the freedom that you have on the page. I mean, there's things that you can do in comics and can't do in film and vice versa. But it was such great source material that it, you know, and having been offered other kind of, you know, comic book adaptations that would have had to go more down the sort of Iron Man, sort of Dark Knight route, it was nice to do something where I could go a little wild with it, you know.
Because it's a kind of a genre mix, a mashup, if you like. There's, you know, there's the kind of indie teen romance is in there, and then you've got the style that you've adapted as well. And there is a kind of, you know, there is a romantic comedy. We mentioned the rom-com earlier with Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, there's so many elements in it. I mean, there's romantic comedy elements, action elements, musical elements. I kind of just go back to just calling it a comedy.
Yeah.
It's just, it will eventually be in the section of Blockbuster, in the comedy section, so I think that's probably what we'll call it.
It's clearly something that interests you anyway, genre, because there's a scene, well, several scenes set in a record store.
Yeah.
Where the kind of genre of records are quite prominent in view, from kind of, you know, rock to pop to sadcore.
I'm glad you spotted the sadcore one. That's pretty briefly on screen.
And
it's also like,
why.
Well, it's when she's breaking up, she's standing in the gloom rock section. So there's, sadcore, and what else is, Knives is also like briefly seen in the math rock section. So I'm glad you spotted that. That's pretty cool.
And that's what I'm here for, so.
That's good. Eagle eyes.
But it did seem to be, because you are sort of reinventing genres as well, and kind of new, I think we're having to invent new categories as a young director.
I think the thing is, I get to make a film every 3 years, so whenever I do, I try and cram in as much as I can. I think that's basically what it is. But they're also, they're called all passions of mine, and they're all things that are in the books. And, you know, it reminded me a little bit of Spaced, Scott Pilgrim, when I read the first book, even though Brian Lee O'Malley had never seen Spaced. That it's essentially about young characters whose lives are governed by the pop culture they consume, or the media, you know, or the, you know, even just the sort of the technology they use. So it kind of felt right that, like, so it kind of covers all bases in that respect. Mm. It covers kind of music, comics, animation, TV, music, film. Did I say music twice?
Okay, but it's very important you should say it
so
as many times as you
third
need
time,
to.
Music three times.
Yeah, you do have a number, I don't know, top 10 charting album at the moment.
I know,
in
I was
US.
Very pleased with that. I know, just under Eminem.
Does that count as yours because you compiled it? Because Beck wrote some of the music, didn't he?
Yeah, well, I sequenced it, I guess. So, like, sort of some of the picks are mine. So there's actually two soundtrack albums, because there's one with all the songs and one with the score by Nigel Godrich. But that was one of the things I hadn't tackled in Spaced or Shaun of Hot Fuzz, was music, and it was, you know, it's a big love of mine. So because the film revolves around bands and band culture, that was really exciting to do.
Yeah, you've always been sort of unashamedly influenced by both kind of, you know, highbrow Buñuel or something. As well as, you know, the kind of great disaster movies, the piranhas of old, and the kind of cheap, you know, B-movie effects movies. You've kind of had, you're kind of taken that aesthetic and kind of created something of your own that is a mix of those two. Have you found that much easier to be conversant with? Is that a dialogue that works better in Hollywood? I know everyone knows you hang out with Quentin Tarantino, who kind of has the mastery of all of that as well.
Not that I went to film school, but you definitely get that feeling that there's kind of like, there's definitely a snobbery about genre in some circles, which I always find weird, because I find that, like, when I was sort of reading up about kind of film and stuff, it wouldn't be that much of a leap to get from, like, sort of Bertolucci to Dario Argento, do you know what I mean? Whereas, like, sort of, so some people would never speak of the two directors in the same sentence, although they did collaborate on a film together, because they both wrote Once Upon a Time in the West.
Did they?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
There you go. Fact. So I guess that's the sort of, I kind of love all cinema, and I think some people just assume that I only love, like, you know, kind of horror films and comedies and stuff. Mm. But
you're extremely fond of, you know, Airplane, and you're extremely fond of, you know, westerns, for
yeah,
example.
Yeah.
And
there's
westerns.
Even, strangely, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World features kind of like something inspired by Peter Greenaway's Drowning by Numbers. Which is probably not the kind of thing that you ever go into a studio and saying, well, this seems a little bit like Drowning My Numbers.
Where do you put Scott Pilgrim then, if we're talking about genre? We mentioned earlier that it's a kind of mix of all of these things. It seems it has youth movie kind of in there. And it kind of, I suppose it's something that Richard Lester was doing, who's an American director who came here and did the Beatles movies. It has some of that playfulness in it.
It's funny, you're now about the fifth person to mention Richard Lester. Five unconnected people have mentioned him, who, you know, I did, you know, like, thinking about it, you know, I used to love Hard Day's Night and Help and the Running, Jumping, Standing Still film. and Superman 2. And the Three Musketeers.
You've got to love the Three Musketeers.
So Sony, yeah, no, I do love the, and the Four Musketeers. So it's interesting. I take that as, well, I take that as a high compliment, because Richard Lester's, you know, like, I mean, I guess that there is that element of like magical realism to it. That a lot of the Hollywood movies are getting super generic. And people have complained a lot about the summer films, with the exception of Inception. It's a difficult one to say. It's a tongue twister. You know, that like people are sort of getting tired of like just all the remakes and stuff. So it was really great to kind of make this as something just a bit different. And like sort of, and when people say that they've never seen anything quite like it, I would take that as the highest compliment, you know. Yeah. And if people say it's a bit like Richard Lester, I also take that as the highest compliment.
Well, it is both highly original and I tapped into a Dick Lester thing.
I just watched Help the other day, in fact, strangely. I hadn't seen it since I was 10.
Edgar, it has been a pleasure to have you in the director's chair. I know you're going to make some more films, loads more, so do keep coming back into our director's chair and see.
I haven't left the UK. I still watch Harry Hill's TV Burp. Yeah, I know what's going on.
Edgar, lovely to see you. Thanks a lot.
And my thanks to Edgar Wright. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World is on release here in the UK from August the 25th. And to watch that interview, which is part of my ongoing series of video interviews with leading directors, do go to guardian.co.uk/in-the-directors-chair. Now, from Seven Evil Exes to another, Zan Brooks. Of course, that seg only really works if you know that Zan is spelled X-A-N, but he's here. Zan Brooks, the Guardian's critic at large.
The evilest ex of them all.
This week, Zan and I will be looking at Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. We'll also look at Adam Sandler in Grown Ups. We'll look at Stieg Larsson's adapted The Girl Who Played With Fire. And then lastly, Zan will tell me about Kim Chapiron's Dog Pound. But we'll start with Scott Pilgrim. We heard Edgar Wright there. You famously went to interview Michael Cera, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Kieran Culkin, and that other bloke with the moustache.
Jason Schwartzman.
Jason Schwartzman. I mean, I've seen the video. You look like a you're rather schoolmasterly with this unruly bunch.
I felt very old in that interview.
I felt very old watching the film.
They were running rings around me. Did this film not... you know, stir up the
I really like Edgar Wright. I really liked Shaun of the Dead, which I think is great.
Yeah.
And I liked Hot Fuzz as well, which, you know, it's not brilliant, but I like it. It's got a great heart and I like its ideas. This one, I'm afraid, did my head in. It starts at 100 miles an hour and it leaves itself with nowhere to go. And then it goes through this kind of rigmarole of seven evil exes. I don't quite know why you have to fight seven evil exes. They all are kind of in some sort of video game fight of all the same. And I know in the interview he talks about how they're the choreography like a dance number. Well, you know, if you look at West Side Story, you get America, you get the Mambo, you get Cool. They're all different. These were all the same. And by the time Evil Exes 5 and 6 popped up and they were twins, I thought, oh, thank God, we're going to get rid of two in one swoop here.
I would agree with you up to a point. I think it's a neat conceit that is cranked out well beyond its natural lifespan. I kind of like the energy of it. Yeah. I like the exuberance of it.
What's it saying, though, Zan, this film?
It's God knows what it's saying. It's saying it's a minefield out there. It's saying that teen romance is full of pain.
Is it though? I thought that that's what it should be saying, but it's not what it did actually say. And that's what a load of critics have kind of been going, well, it's all about, but it isn't about that.
Well, it struck me as, I mean, it's a comic book, but it's almost like one of those teen photo stories.
Yeah,
like a teen romance photo story, but played as a sort of Xbox game.
Yeah.
So when you're battling your demons, they are literal demons that you have to sort of best in mortal combat. I thought that was all right. I thought that was fine. It does go on, though, and it's one note. It never really develops. I also found, you know, there's a sort of, it's guilty in its sort of geeky way of a certain misogyny, I think. In that it suggests that beautiful girls are these sort of cool, passive agents of ruin that sort of stand listlessly to one side looking at their nails while their ex-boyfriends kind of set upon their current suitor. But I way preferred it to you. I thought it was playful, it was brash. I was entertained by it, but it did go on too long.
Well, we've certainly covered it very well on our site, here on Film Weekly, anywhere else, because it had to spit audience. Maybe it's a Marmite kind of movie and that video games are a Marmite kind of culture. I don't know, but there you go. You can see Edgar Wright on our site talking in the director's chair about his wider art, indeed. And you can see the rest of the cast talking to Zan, getting a ticking off from Zan as well for not dressing right.
They didn't take me seriously at all. They laughed at me, Jason.
They laughed at your face. Mary Elizabeth Winstead, I think she thought you were rather lovely.
She was just being polite.
Do you think? Mm. I think she fancied you.
Do you reckon? Mm. They all do.
Let's move on to Adam Sandler and Grown Ups. Another kind of tale of arrested development. Michael Cera, he was in Arrested Development on telly. See what I've done there?
Yeah, these links are just great.
Good, aren't I? This is Adam Sandler, who, after the death of a beloved basketball coach, reunites with his former high school teammates at a lakeside retreat with their families to reminisce about life, the universe, and hot girls in hot pants.
Hey, Lenny, remember we used to come here in high school late night after we got wasted?
What's wasted?
Nice one, Aggie.
Wasted, kids, is something that happens when you have a hankering for ice cream.
Well, I want to get wasted.
I want to get totally wasted.
I want to get wasted every single day of my life.
I want to get chocolate wasted.
No, you don't need to get wasted. It's okay.
Adam Sandler and co. explaining the rules of adulthood to their younger brethren. Is this a generational clash comedy, Zan? What sort of
comedy? Yeah, I suppose, this is sort of Adam Sandler's Wild Strawberries, isn't it? It's a tale of growing old and mortality and making peace with your past. And it's really bad. It's really shockingly bad, and we went into this.
I can't believe you put Adam Sandler and Wild Strawberries in the same sentence. He probably knew someone called Bergman, but I'm sure he went to school with him. But this
probably
is not the same.
Probably flushed his head
way
down the toilet. this was really shocking.
I think Adam Sandler's career has two barrels, the hits and the misses. The misses is obviously a larger, rather swelling barrel.
Yeah, this, it's a warehouse.
This for me flops right into the middle of that barrel and sits somewhere near that, scraping the bottom of it. Because, Punch Drunk Love, fine. Funny People recently, yeah. I thought was really rather good. His Judd Apatow comedy. And interestingly, in that he plays a Hollywood big shot gone sour, this comedian who's kind of done too many rubbish films and is now reflecting bitterly on his life. Here he's a Hollywood big shot again.
Which we know right in the very opening scene where his first line is, I'm the biggest agent in Hollywood, just so we know. So we go, oh, okay, he's
that,
the biggest agent in Hollywood.
And that gives him an excuse to behave like an absolute git.
But you know, they're all behaving like absolute gits
of
various stripes.
They're horrible to each other.
Yeah.
They're all supposed to be like childhood friends, but all they do is insult each other and each other's wives.
Laugh at each other, take joy in each other's, pain and humiliation. Talking about Scott Pilgrim's sexual politics being a little bit dubious, this really kind of tunnels into the ground.
Why is that? Because even
it?
On the poster, you've got the adults, which is Kevin James, David Spade, Rob Schneider. Yeah. I use adults very loosely here as a term.
Yeah.
And Chris Rock and Adam Sandler. And then underneath, you've got Salma Hayek, Maya Rudolph. You've got some other girl, the
Maria
girl
Bello.
In Hot Pants. Maria Bello is in there as well. But what are the women? They're the wives in this, and the girlfriends, and also the daughters, and the people to be ogled at.
Yeah, ogled or disgusted. By.
Or
there's
used
the obligatory
as a teat,
farting granny because people are truly disgusting.
And she's black as well, just
she's
in case.
Black, so she's a bit sassy, but she farts. there's the character of Rob Schneider's wife who's in her 60s and is therefore utterly disgusting because she still has sex with Rob Schneider. Whereas the teen hottie who mends her car with her ass in the air, they can kind of stare at. A great length. I mean, it's
really
a scene that went
scene.
For about 10 minutes, I think.
Yes. And Salma Hayek, there's a reference to her breasts.
I like Salma Hayek.
Like
what
Salma
the
Hayek.
Hell
Who
is she
like
doing
Hayek?
In this?
Ed Norton doesn't like Salma Hayek.
She doesn't like him.
No, good. Grown Ups and Fart Gags, that is Adam Sandler. The Swedish film, The Girl Who Played With Fire, that will we be examining next. I'm going to speak to the director of that film, who is Daniel Alfredson, in a minute. But just to fill people in case they've had their head up Adam Sandler's farting bottom for the last few years, this is the second in the trilogy of the Millennium Trilogy, which is written by Stieg Larsson, which is now made into films. They're going to be made into Hollywood films. Are you a follower? Are you a reader of these books?
I haven't read any of them.
No, neither have I.
Good. And I guess
people are going to email in and sort of say, dare you,
no,
lazy
they will.
Journalists.
They will. Should we lie about that?
No.
No?
No, I've been reading War and Peace recently.
No, you haven't. Even Razzle is your reading matter
of
choice.
Well, that was his research for grown-ups.
So this is, I guess, the centrepiece of the trilogy. After The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and to be followed by, what was it, The Girl Who Ate Her Own Foot or something, I think is the third one.
Who kicked the hornet's nest,
That's
then
the
ate her own foot to ease the pain.
Whereas the first film I thought was worked as a standalone thriller, this is very much part of a franchise and it ends in a bit of a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And felt a little bit more schematic, a little bit more absurd because of that. Not quite as successful.
I've settled into it more.
Oh, you've settled.
But I didn't really look forward to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo because I hadn't read the book. Yeah. I felt guilty about it. And I kind of liked it. I thought it was all right. A bit lurid and violent and graphic in point, in parts, in a kind of sort of safe way. And now I'm sort of in that world. I'm like, well, I might as well sort of get with these people and find out more about Lisbeth
Salander.
Well,
you find out a lot more about, there's an awful lot of backstory in this
on
the Lisbeth Salander character.
Which I thought, well, I should know now because she's very famous as a character and she's going to be remade in Hollywood and played by Rooney Mara.
Rooney Mara. There you go.
She's very famous. Opposite Daniel Craig.
Yeah, which is an odd choice, but probably a good one.
Can you tell me about a film that which I didn't see, but I wanted to? It's called Dog Pound, directed by Kim Chapiron, who is a sort of, he's a kind of disciple of Vincent Cassel, who is a great French actor. And he's
and the partner of Ludwig Sagnier.
Is he the partner of Ludwig
Sagnier?
I think
he is, yes.
Ooh.
He certainly had children with her. I don't know whether they're still
together. Yes, they've only just recently had a child, haven't they? Because she was going to be in François Ozon's film, The Refuge.
That's right,
because he wanted her to be pregnant during that. She said no, or maybe Kim said no. In fact, because Kim said, no, I don't want my wife to go through that because I am going to make a film about prisons.
Well, it's a youth correctional facility in Montana. It's an American film. I guess it's like it's a pocket un prophète in that it's about the education or the miseducation of a trio of kids who come into this brutal environment and either survive or go under. I don't think it tells us anything we didn't know about prisons. There's, you know, there are riots, there are rapes, there are suicides, there are drug deals.
Hold on, I used to watch Porridge. There was never any of that.
Never any of that in Porridge. Again, it should have had the piranha effect of livening up a bit. But it does it very well.
Yeah.
It's really well acted by a cast of complete unknowns.
I mean, I looked down the list, never heard of any of them.
Yeah, they're really good in it. It's properly tense, and it's a small film that has total confidence within its narrow boundary.
But then the front door opens, and who walks in? The fucking mom. I think she's gonna either bitch me out or make some small talk and go off to bed, but no. She takes off her jacket, she's wearing this dress that makes her titties just pop right out, and then she comes and she sits right next to me. I don't know what the hell to say, so I'm just trying to watch TV, but I could see out of the corner of my eye that she's looking at me. And then she says, can I get a drag of that? And I'm like, sure. So I'm watching her smoke.
It reminds me of the little clip I've seen. It reminds me very much of the first time I came across Scum. Hadn't heard of anyone.
Yeah.
Ray Winston and all that lot that are in there. Does it owe something to Alan Clark's
drama? I think it does. I don't think it has quite the raw intensity
of
Scum.
It was one of the scariest shows I've ever seen.
It's a little bit more obviously plotted in terms of where these three characters are going. But I did find it completely gripping, and it's, my God, it's way better than most of the other films that are out this week.
So, Dog Pound, your film of the week?
It is, yeah.
Kim Chapiron's Dog Pound wins Zan's bark of approval. I'm going to have to go for The Girl Who Played With Fire, simply because I haven't seen Dog Pound, much to my upset. And Scott Pilgrim, how's that going to do? I don't know. I hope Edgar Wright goes on. He's going to make Ant-Man next.
He's going to make Ant-Man, but he's going to be fine. Scott Pilgrim, whether you like it or not, is going to do really well.
He's going to do okay. Didn't do great in America, but did all right.
Did all right. You know, it's just low budget. Just because it wasn't number one, they're saying it's a failure.
Number one. There is only number one. There is no second. Adam Sandler.
That's the American way.
The Expendables is number one. Told you it would be.
Yeah, you did, didn't you? My God, this is, you know, I'm so off the pace.
Probably a good thing. Zan, lovely to see you. Evil X Zan Brooks. For more of his interviews, reviews and thoughts, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Over the past couple of years, it is entirely possible that there wasn't a single mode of public transport in the world that wasn't carrying someone reading one of Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy of novels. Well, that's how it seemed to me, anyway. As Hollywood revs up its high-gloss film adaptations of Larsson's work, the second Swedish-language film in the series, The Girl Who Played With Fire, gets its UK release.
It's directed by Daniel Alfredson, who Zan earlier rightly spotted is the brother of Let the Right One In director Thomas Alfredson. This film is a tightly focused thriller that will no doubt please the fans of the books and maybe win some more over. So it was with great pleasure that I caught up with Daniel Alfredson here in London earlier this week. Daniel Alfredson, welcome to Film Weekly. We've had your brother on the show. I think you're the first brother, directing brothers, we've had on Film Weekly.
Okay, that's fantastic. I'm very proud.
Yeah. It's amazing, because his film, Let the Right One In, was one of our favourites. And it's obviously just had a Hollywood remake called Let Me In. Yeah. Now, your next two films, I don't know, they're being Hollywood remade as well. The Alfredsons have got a pull on Hollywood.
Yeah, they want to remake us. I don't know, but that's how it is. Well, I'm just—it's okay for me. Mm. If they want to do it again, I'm happy about it. But on the other hand, I made the original.
Yeah, I mean, is this Swedish film, the Swedish film industry, which is obviously quite a small community, given that you and your brother are half of it. Yeah. Do they take this as a compliment that Hollywood wants to remake its stories? It means that they're doing something right. It means that they're kind of appealing, at least on a broad scale.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's important for Swedish film industry to have some international success. And I think it's a big thing for Sweden and for other filmmakers in Sweden.
Now, I mean, we always think of the Swedes here in England. I don't know what you think of yourselves, but we always think of it as a kind of very clean, kind of happy land of high living standards. Here you are presenting Sweden to a very wide audience all of a sudden. And suddenly Stockholm, which previously to me was a very beautiful city, full of expensive vodka and overpriced beer, is now full of corrupt politicians and paedophiles and computer hackers. Is this the image of Sweden we really want to see? And vampires, sorry.
Yeah, probably. It seems like it anyway. But I think every society has sort of a dark side. And Sweden is not unique in any sense. I think for a Swedish audience, we don't really have that image of ourselves, really, as you probably have of Sweden. And I think Stieg Larsson wanted to use the darkness as well in the stories and made sort of entertaining stories about it. So,
and you as a filmmaker, did that influence the way you, you know, even on the basic level, lit the project, even the way you approached the design of it?
Yeah, in some ways it did, and we tried to stick as close to the books or to the idea of the books while shooting the film, and that was part of the idea, to use even the dark sides. Mm. But I think you can see some very nice shots of Stockholm as well in the film, and I think that put something, the complexity between the nice, clean outside and the darkness within.
I must say it gives it a nice grit. Actually, it makes it more attractive, really, as a visit. You know, it kind of gives it that kind of edge that it perhaps had been missing. But it is the details that I like in this film. There's this very quick scene in a synagogue, for example, a Swedish synagogue, which I'd never seen a Swedish synagogue before, but it's very quick and obviously tells us that Bublansky is Jewish, but that's it. And, you know, only a film would have the budget to actually make that shot, even, I think.
Well, I actually had to fight a bit to have that scene because I thought it was very important. And I think I'm also very... I like those details in Stieg Larsson's book as well, because he says that Bublansky, he walks to the synagogue at one time in the book, but he never really, it's not really important that he's Jewish. And I like that, because Sweden is full of immigrants and people from other countries, and of course, there's a doctor with an Indian name from India, and he's Swedish, and he's a doctor. And Stieg Larsson never mentions why, no background, no nothing, but he's from India.
It just enriches the tapestry, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And it ties it to the sort of Nazi element that was in the Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah, it's part of it. And that was also a very important part for Stieg Larsson, because he was always fighting the neo-Nazism in Scandinavia and in Sweden.
There's also the thesis in the book that the
the student has done this thesis on sex trafficking. Yeah. I see it's titled From Russia with Love.
Yeah.
And then up comes this huge, blonde, giant brute of a man who immediately reminded me of Robert Shaw in From Russia with Love. Is there a slight homage there? Is that filmmaking or the book?
I would say it's from the book to start with, because then that's really in the book. And From Russia with Love, it's a sort of a joke, really. I think Stieg Larsson, he was looking at James Bond and several other things, and he just borrowed things.
Yeah. So it is the fact that he's blonde like that. It is supposed to look like Robert Shaw.
He's supposed to look like him. So
on that one. The success of the film, as we mentioned, is now going to Hollywood with David Fincher, and Daniel Craig is now playing Blomqvist. Is that right? Who I think would look very good. I think I don't know what Michael Nyquist feels about it.
I think he's happy. I think he's happy because Daniel Craig is a bit younger than him, I think. So no, I'm curious about it. I'm looking forward to see it.
Do you think he'll still wear that same leather jacket and granddad t-shirt smock thing?
I don't think so. He will probably be very well dressed.
I mean, Elizabeth Salander, who I think... In I don't know about the third film, but in your second film, it really becomes, we learn much more about her and her character and this performance by Noomi Rapace. Rooney Mara is now going to play a total unknown bait to many people. I saw her in Nightmare on Elm Street. She was actually rather good in it. That sort of such a hot property, that role has become perhaps the most famous Swedish woman in history.
Probably. I think it will be very hard for her to convince me to be Lisbeth Salander, because I believe Noomi is, she's my Lisbeth.
Yeah.
And she will be. She will be.
The other most famous Swedish girl in history is the girl who was the vampire in your brother's film, I suppose.
Yeah, she's very she's very Swedish also.
But he's well your brother, because he came and accepted his Best Foreign Film award from our critics circle last year. So I saw him there. Is he well?
Yeah, he's very well. I'm staying with him in London right now because he's in pre-production here.
He's making a Hollywood film now, isn't he?
No, not really. He's working for making a film out of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Oh, it's the John le Carré film, a British film.
Yeah. So we spent some time during the weekend together.
Lovely.
Yeah, fantastic.
What was the relationship to you as filmmakers? Have you worked together before? He's older than you, if I may. He won't.
No.
He's not older than you.
No, he's younger than me.
Really? Well, he dresses older than you.
Yeah, he is. No, we have never really worked together. But on the other hand, we have a sort of... we tend to read each other's scripts. And I always like him to come into the editing room and listen to him and his ideas.
Well, I look forward to the third one, the Hornet's Nest, and finding out what happened. Because there's some things unanswered, Daniel, I've got to be honest with you. And I know David Fincher said he's going to film... in Sweden for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. He's going to film some of it in Sweden. I don't know how much. Have they approached you? Are you going to kind of show him around Stockholm, show him a few of the seedier side?
No, I'm not into that at all. But I'm happy that he's filming in Sweden, because I believe this is a very Swedish story to begin with. And of course, I wouldn't be surprised if they have moved it to America and made it somewhere else in America. So I'm very happy that they will use Stockholm again, because I think Stockholm deserves it.
My thanks to Daniel Alfredson there, and The Girl Who Played With Fire is on general release here in the UK from Friday the 25th of August. Incidentally, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest is released towards the end of October. Meanwhile, here at Film Weekly, we have 5 pretty funky t-shirts of The Girl Who Played With Fire to give away. Very stylish they are too. All you have to do to win one is sign up to our Film Weekly fans group on Facebook. Your name will go into a hat and we'll announce the winners. So go on there, sign up with your name, tell us what size t-shirt you are, and you stand the chance of winning one. They're very stylish. They've got a nice kind of dragony tattoo kind of thing on there. You'll look very cool, just like Lisbeth Salander, only without the smoking. The music featured on this week's show is Nigel Godrich's score for Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Yes, fifth member of Radiohead there, giving his film chops an airing. Next week, I'll be meeting Stephen Frears to talk about the brilliant Tamara Drew, and talented young actor Martin Compston tells me why soul took root in the North. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday if you want a comprehensive guide to the week's film releases and the world's film gossip. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's see you next week and goodbye.